So welcome to our monthly gathering between Tahoma and Watermoon Dojo. Greetings to all of you on the internet, as well as those here in the Zendo at Tahoma. We have been reading through Torii Nji, Zenji's Discourse on the Inexhaustible Lamp of the Zen School. It's been a couple of months since our last get-together. So I will remind us that we are reading through Chapter 2, which is on faith and practice. And the structuring of this is on the saying that those who wish to make a hands-on investigation of Zen must have great faith, great dedication, great doubt. That's the classic saying, as I have commented numerous times in various instances, that translation is actually fairly inaccurate. Typically, or more accurately, would be great trust, the determination of great fury, and apprehension, well, great apprehension and uncertainty. So, since I've talked about those before, I won't go into them in great depth. But in this section of the Inexhaustible Lamp, Torii is rooting, at least what they're translating as faith, into the earliest teachings of the Buddha. It's beginning with, well, let me rephrase that, to what's kind of mythologically the earliest teachings of the Buddha. This is the Huayan Sutras, which is supposed to be the Buddha speaking straight from realization, and it was not understood, so he provided many skillful means, beginning with the Four Noble Truths and so on. The Huayan Sutras, or the Flower Garland Sutra, are of course much, much later sutras, so probably not actual utterances of the Buddha. But it's a pretty, it's a very large collection of actually several sutras, and he's kind of quoted a little bit throughout this beginning of this. And it is today, if you're at the very end, depending on how far we get here, he'll actually begin to talk about faith, right? Which is, in the way Torii is putting it, is much clearly he's talking about trust. Trust in the method, trust in the practice. Which is what the root of the great trust that you're supposed to have in the classic slogan of great trust, determination of great fury, and great apprehension and uncertainty. So let us begin. We are reading section 90, which is on page 146 of the text, for those of you with your own copies of the text or the PDF. Followers of the Buddha, the wisdom of the Tathagata is also like this. It is free, unhindered, and of benefit to all sentient beings. It is contained in their very bodies, but alas, since they foolishly indulge in vain fancies and clinging attachments, they are not aware of it, cannot realize it, and thus cannot reap the benefit of it. Daibei's comment. The wisdom of the Tathagata is also like this. As this great sutra, by that he means the Huayan Sutra, is contained in a particle of dust, so all sentient beings are endowed with and contain this wisdom of the Tathagata. So in the previous bits that we read, there is this whole metaphor of this fractal nature of the Huayan Sutra, that every bit of it is contains the whole, and that because it is this elucidation from realization. And so since all of reality in the Buddhist metaphysics is interconnected and interpenetrating, right? So every bit of it reflects the whole. And so the sutra being like a elucidation of this, and they're giving this a lot of credit, right? In Chan, we typically spend much more time saying that words can never get at the ineffable, but they're, because the the Flower Garland Sutra was supposedly this speaking straight from realization. You know, it's given the same as being indistinguishable, really, from reality. So he says, continues on, "This is true, but alas, because of foolishness, delusion, they indulge in vain fancies and sticky attachments and are not aware of this." And so when they say foolishness, which is in parentheses delusion, so there they're talking about the root of the three poisons, right, which are delusion or ignorance, it's often translated, or foolishness, in the case that they have it here, and then anger and greed are the canonical way they're put there, but it's really delusion, grasping, and rejecting. That's the, perhaps how I would put it, following after other people, of course, which is trying to get more of what we like and push away what we don't like. Those are the reactions we have, and those come from our root delusion that we're separate beings. That's the core delusion, and so delusion is typically better than foolishness. Ignorance also, I think, gets at that ignorance of the reality of things. Ignorance might be the best of those possible translations. "Thus, they stray from the way and cannot reap the benefit of the wisdom of the Tathagata inherent in them." So for those of you that actually have the text, there's kind of a long parenthetical here that I'm not going to read because it's like really, it's an error. But we'll kind of elucidate in the next section what they were trying to get at. So section 91. "With his wisdom eye of unobstructed purity, the Tathagata saw all sentient beings in all the Dharma realms and exclaimed, 'How wondrous, how wondrous! All sentient beings are inherently endowed with the wisdom and virtue of the Tathagata. Yet, due to foolishness, they go astray, do neither know nor see. I truly shall teach the great way, and so forever deliver them from vain fancies and sticky attachments. And as the wisdom is in their own bodies, I shall cause them to see that the vast wisdom of the Tathagata is not different from Buddha.'" So here it's interesting, he makes this distinction between the Tathagata and Buddha, which is often used interchangeably. The Tathagata means thus come, right? And it's kind of used as another way of looking at. So it's like the Buddha as being indistinguishable from fundamental reality. Right? And the interesting thing on this is that, you know, this is what he was supposedly said when he saw the Venus, the morning star, and awakened. Was this, how wondrous, all sentient beings are inherently endowed with the wisdom and virtue of the Tathagata. Right? So he's saying that, he said it's wonderful that everyone is, basically he's saying that everyone is part of fundamental reality. And that the sense of separateness to it is this illusion that we have. And thus it's not something that you gain. Right, that's the really essential thing that is going on here. And then he goes on and basically makes his vow, right, that I will teach the great way. And I think this is probably comes down from translation, where they talk about I will deliver them and cause them to see. I mean, it's a little too much agency, right? The Buddha's teaching is really that, like, he basically says, look, here's the problem. He diagnoses the problem, our attachments. And then says, well, the solution to that problem is to drop the barrier between self and other, right? The sense of separateness, to do this work that you have to do on yourself. And then he gives some like, here are some ways to do that. And then over the centuries, the millennia, there's been more and more different ways. These are the skillful means. Dibi's comment on this is that, so this also begins with this long parenthetical where they note that this is one of the cases where Toré was writing in Chinese, and thus it's susceptible to myriad translations. So there's kind of like a way that they say that you can completely reread this section in a different way, but it's not that different, so I'm going to skip that. How wondrous, all sentient beings are inherently endowed with the wisdom and virtue of the Tathagata. This is what Sakyamuni uttered on awakening, and it may also be expressed by, having attained the way, Buddha sees the Dharma realm. Having attained the way, fully realized it, he sees it with the Tathagata's wisdom eye, the pure wisdom eye without any obstruction, which sees that all sentient beings in the Dharma realm inherently have the wisdom and virtue of the Buddha. However, sentient beings are ignorant of this because each one has foolishly gone astray. It should not be so. So, here he's quoting again, I shall truly teach the great way and deliver them forever from vain fancies and sticky attachments, enabling each one in his own body to become aware of the vast wisdom of the Tathagata with which he was endowed from the beginning and thus become Buddha. This was Sakyamuni's first utterance and aspiration on awakening when he had become Buddha. So, Taibi, along with Tori, sticking with the canonical story here for the most part, with some slight little nuances to it. Vain fancies and sticky attachments is not at least what I've read in translations from the original sutra, but this is how they've come to think of it. The vain fancies is our delusion of separateness, right? That we are this individual ego moving through the world, right? We just move through this world. And the sticky attachments are we move to this world trying to make things better for us, for ourselves, that false sense of the separate. And then he makes this point, he says, each one in his own body, he's made this point several times, in his own body, from one view one could take is that from the point of view of the absolute, of course, there are no bodies, right? From that view, right? But from the view from the relative, right? But in the Chan and Zen view, there is, there's no real distinction in that either. But one has to go through the relative view or one sees no distinctions before one is able to then see that view manifest in form, right? So this is what Tori calls the discrimination of forms. He talks about earlier in the text, but he's going to talk about it a lot more later in the text. So he's kind of working from that view, though, even though I think one could be this could be misleading in looking at the idea that this is contained within the body. That was the problem with these two parentheticals that I skipped. They really made this seem like something you attain. And that's really, you can argue that's a skillful means to say that one has this attainment. Sometimes that word is used, attainment, for that. But it's much more commonly for them to, various teachers to write that upon awakening you see that there was nothing to attain and that all one's notions and ideas of what the awakened condition is like are always wrong because that's the separate self coming up with those notions and ideas or maybe even some societal as well as societal notions and concepts. It's also very entangled, right? This is why I tend to not use the word enlightenment. It's also entangled with the enlightenment, right? The enlightenment notions of the West is that man can completely understand everything, not necessarily individually, but we can figure out everything, right? This is the beginning of the science in that view, objective science. That we can figure out, we can use various techniques to reduce everything to their constituent parts and figure everything out. So that has gotten, especially in the Enlightenment, which was kind of the first Western interest in the East, that they got very tangled together. And the idea of Enlightenment was this, that you could, you would be knowing in that way, right? What I often refer to as the enlightened ego, right? You have this enlightened sense of self. Right, it's had some insight, and you can do that. And that's what people think. It's like, I'll be just like I am, except I will have insight into everything. That's often how people see that. And then if they have the actual awakening, they find it's not like that. Torah, section 92. By making sentient beings follow the great way, they get delivered of vain fancies. Once freed of these, the authentication of the vast wisdom of the Tathagata is entered, and so all sentient beings are benefited and gladdened. Dibe's comment on this. The above proclamation and aspiration of the Buddha is quoted from the Kagon Sutra. And the Kagon Sutra is, of course, the Huayan, or Flower Garden Sutra. Below, Master Torah gives a detailed exposition of faith and then explains the vows. Faith in the heart and the vows for practice give life to Buddhism, no matter of what the school. So this is the beginning of what this chapter is all about. So these first, however many pages we've read, have been kind of Torah's introduction. And of course, as I've noted before, Torah's text is very terse, and it's really expanded by Master Dibe's comments. But the compression of Torah's text means that we are all grateful for Dibe's comments, even if sometimes he goes on at length. So let's read his section on faith, which, as I noted, is probably more accurately should be trust. But we'll stick with what the text says. Faith is the first requirement, right? And this is once again referencing the great faith, great determination, great doubt. Faith is the first requirement, and with it the vows are taken. Faith is the life spring of all religions, not of Buddhism alone. In the teachings of religion, the first outright demand is to have faith in God, or faith in Buddha. But if demanded thus categorically, people get bewildered and fail to understand. Perhaps they have never bothered about religion, neither seen nor known God or Buddha, and so wonder what they are meant to have faith in, and in what way. As to the Pure Land school and Christianity have a seeming advantage because their object of faith is clear. But our Zen school has no such object of faith. So when teaching faith in the mind and demanding that when training, we must indeed have the great root of faith, we need to make quite clear what faith is. Thus, our gratitude goes to Master Torah for the following detailed exposition on faith. So there's important things in this, particularly this second paragraph. He begins his first paragraph in this on faith section is kind of a little scan of religions in general. But then he says, as to that, the Pure Land school and Christianity have a seeming invalid advantage because their object of faith is clear. So in the first paragraph, he talked about, well, the root of these religions is you have to have faith in God. And then he always kind of, as a side, says, or the Buddha. And when he says that, that is a reference to the Pure Land school, where the Buddha is more like a god, right? Not exactly, like not a creator god, but like a divine being that can help one on the way, right? And this isn't really confined to just the Pure Land school. After 2,500 years, Buddhism that spread all over, and it just became kind of a religion in many, many places, right? I was listening to recently a podcast from this person who's a kind of long-term teacher in various ways, and talking to a person who was a younger, newer practitioner, but a very dedicated practitioner of both yoga and of Theravadan Buddhism, and had spent time in the East, I forget where, maybe Thailand, studying in various Theravadan sects. And in the course of this, the person who was being interviewed, the spiritual teacher type person, he noted that contemporary Theravadan practices says is kind of incoherent. And this other person who was a Theravadan practitioner really kind of pressed him on this, and he says, well, the reason is because Theravadan practice as we do it now, and you know, this in the U.S. is usually called insight meditation, that's how they kind of translated that, is because it's really new, just like yoga is really new. They claim like these really old histories of it, but really, by new I mean in the last 150 years. So in the late 19th century, in these countries that are all colonized, right, in the East, they decide to bring Buddhism into modernity. And what this guy noted, and I'm no expert on this, I'm really relying on what this guy said, is he said that they stripped out basically all this magic, what we would just think of as just magic, and that Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, had really turned into, and it depended on the culture, because it absorbed the kind of shamanistic culture of every one of the countries it went to, and a kind of form of shamanism is what was really practiced in most countries, really worldwide. You know, animism often is the root of shamanism. And so, in this case, the Buddha was this more divine type person, bodhisattvas and such, or the Theravadan equivalent of those, arhats, right, were more like, great, like maybe angels, almost, or saints, great saints, right? Bodhisattvas are often equivalent to saints. So this has this tendency to become religified, right? So faith in the Buddha. And so at the end of this, well, not the end, but in this story, she then says, in the Zen school, there is no object of faith, right? So there is no, like, the Buddha will deliver you, right? So that actual statement, that's why I wanted to make that point about that, where the Buddha says, quoted in some original early sutra as saying, like, I will deliver these people. That's very much more this, like, Buddha as savior. It's a very much more like of a Christ-like thing to say, right? Through me, you can enter heaven type of thing, right? Which, like I said, at least in the translations I've read of these very earliest sutras, is a good Bhikkhu Bodhi collection of those. It's not quite how he puts it. But anyway, he notes that in Zen, we don't have that, right? The whole thing is you have to see this for yourself. Here's the practices, get at it, right? That's the procedure. So there's no object. And then he says, and this is in scare quotes, he says, faith in the mind, when teaching faith in the mind. So that is a reference to the Xingjing Ming, right? Which is translated, it's most accurately translated as inscriptions on trust in mind, right? And one of the kind of academic analysis of that piece is that in many ways it was written as a response to the rise of Pure Land. Pure Land and Chan in China arose at about the same time. They're both Chinese expressions of Buddhism, of Indian Buddhism. And so the stressing on the trust in the Buddha to the point where it's only needing to chant the Buddha's name, to then awaken in the Western paradise where you have a much better chance of, or being reborn in the Western paradise, you have a much better chance of awakening. And that's the kind of faith elements of the Pure Land. The Buddha is always there to guide and protect and help you along the way. But in Chan, at this point, they're saying you need to have faith in, or trust in mind. And by that, they're meaning trust in fundamental reality, trust in things as they are, and seeing this for yourself. And that's why that text, Inscriptions on Trust in Mind, is fairly short and encapsulates really the essence of Chan practice. The whole thing is there. Everything else is just people talking at length about it, or giving you, different sets of skillful means and talking about length about them, or commenting on things other people have said, or maybe in very limited cases, maybe metaphysical type things or ramifications of this, or how to behave in the world after awakening, things like that. I mean, that's the huge amount of the discussion is on that. But the actual core of this is of how the world is, what the human condition is, and how we see into the nature of things, right? As he was saying here, how we let go of our vain fancies and sticky attachments, enabling each one in his own body to become aware of the vast wisdom of the Tathagata. Right? So that's what we're doing. So that's the Zen Chan orientation. on that. And the Xinjiang Ming, you know, in like a few hundred words, gets to all of that. And so, what Daibi says here is that because what we're saying is our, right, so what is the trust in that? What's the trust in the process, right? Faith in the process. That something as simple as what's outlined in the Xinjiang Ming, though there's some convoluted turns of phrase in that particular piece. So what is that? How does that compare to faith in God or the Pure Landish faith in the Buddha? And that is what's going to be examined on that. And that's why this chapter is faith and practice, right? Because that's what the trust is in. We trust that if we go through this process, that it will work, right? That it'll work for us. And, you know, they had, of course, different concepts on that, per se. There's a thing in Da Hui's letters where he says to one of these people, he says, you know, even if you don't awaken now, because he's writing to this kind of elderly person, he says, you engage in this practice, he says, even if you don't awaken now, you will put down good roots for later lives, right? So that's kind of the Chinese orientation, even though the intellectual, kind of scholar intellectual types that were really in the, you know, were in the monasteries, didn't quite have a belief in reincarnation to the same degree that maybe a Pure Lander would, or certainly as they did in Indian Buddhism. But that's still, I think, an orientation that you know, can engender faith. But my view is always that reincarnation, or any the afterlife in any way, the Pure Land, any of these things are all in the realm of no knowing. And so we work on awakening in this lifetime. And so our great trust has to be that the process works. And considering that the whole first chapter was Tore going through the lineage, beginning with the mythological Buddhas, then going through all of the people up to Hakuin, it's like he laid the foundations there. We have this whole group of men who went through the process, you know, as the process changed over the thousands of years. But the core of it retained that we have to see this for ourselves, that we can engage in some practices. And, you know, a practice like Zazen has not really changed since the Buddha's day. You know, how they talk about it and the orientation is there, has changed. You know, the rumor is that the Buddha was engaged in breath counting when he had his great awakening. I mean, who knows if that's true, if that's just somebody trying to sell Susokan a little bit more, but certainly that goes all the way back to Indian Buddhism, to the earliest days, breath work, working with inquiry in different ways, goes back to the earliest Buddhism, and just it gets shifted to work with the different cultures that it's in. And that is our great trust. And as Daibi concludes here, he says, faith is like a compass on a foggy sea, the magnetic needle that points in the direction. Master Tore's heart was brim full of it. And as he is talking from his heart, so we must listen with our heart. And note here that anytime they say heart, of course, that's going to be heart-mind, right? Most of the time, when translating Xin, Zen, Xin in Chinese, in a Buddhist context, actually just translating it as mind is the most appropriate. But sometimes heart is more appropriate. So when he says he is talking from his heart, that's probably more appropriate, right? And he says, so we must listen with our heart. But I would say that one, we should say we should listen with our heart mind. Right? So that is, I think, the correct, appropriate orientation for listening to any talk on this material, but certainly engaging with this particular material. As noted, is faith is like a compass on a foggy sea. So it's what orients us, keeps us coming to the cushion, right? It's trust that if we engage in this practice, things will flower out of it. You know, and there's many, many things that flower out of it that are not, you know, that are kind of like side effects, right? But they're part of it, part of the deal. As we work through our conditioning, we become more open people, more at ease. We have more equanimity. This all just makes us better people in the world. And that's part of it. It's not what you're directly working towards, but it's a necessary component of it. So there's always a continual flowering of it. And we have to have this trust in that, that this will continue to do it. Because at first it just seems like we just have to get past pain in the knees or back pain or whatever, right? Boredom for some people. But the rope that we use to pull us through the fog is this trust that the practice works. So, hold on to that. It is when people lose that that they stop, you know, that they kind of drift away from the practice. Doesn't seem to be working for them or something. They say things like that, well, I'm just not getting anywhere. In some rare cases, they kind of think they've gotten all they can out of it. That's another thing there. But these all come from this kind of dwindling of one's faith in the process. So, hold tight to that. Just remember, you know, whatever it is that kind of can help you on that, the lineage can be helpful, or looking at other practitioners. You know, the lineage that we have all passed down from these men, but there were many women practitioners as well. The book, The Hidden Lamp, goes through many, many different women practitioners. So this is a great, instead of it being this kind of thin thread of the lineage, this is a great bush of practitioners of all ages and of all nationalities and of all sexes and all orientations. And there's really just a great community of awakened people who have helped other people on that. And that can be a useful thread to hold on to, and that is just this great collection of people that we know have gone through the process and it's worked. And many contemporary people as well, and many, 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 you know, too many books are written about people's own personal experience out there. But they're there, and they can help one in holding on to one's faith. And then that brings you to the important part, which is that hands-on investigation into this great matter.